Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. In 1773 and 74, very few American colonists entertained the idea of separating from Great Britain. 2 years later, Thomas Jefferson penned the Declaration of Independence. In October 1923, Cincinnatians were in a funk, weighed down by a corrupt and oppressive political machine. A year later, they had come together to draft and adopt a new city charter. Often in the midst of the bleakest moments, something fresh is stirring just below the surface, ready to break through. And almost always, what becomes a celebrated revolutionary change starts at the most local grassroots level. At this moment, when people are worried whether American democracy will survive, Sarah Van Gelder traveled the country in her camper in search of people creating alternative solutions. Her travels and insights are chronicled in The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-Mile Journey Through a New America. She joins us today. Ms. Van Gelder visited Cincinnati on her travels, focusing on several initiatives, including the Cincinnati Union Co-op Initiative. We are also joined by the CUCI's Executive Director, Kristen Barker. Well, Sarah Van Gelder and Kristen Barker, great to have you here on Cincinnati Edition. And Sarah, welcome to Cincinnati.
Thank you so much.
I know you've been here before. It's part of the book. But it's always nice to have you come back.
And I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much.
This book didn't happen in a vacuum. You founded Yes Magazine. You've been working on writing things from a particular perspective for a long time. So to get us started here, what were the questions? What were the hypotheses that maybe you wanted to set out to test as you set out on this 12,000-mile journey?
Yeah. So after nearly 20 years at Yes Magazine, I was starting to wonder if some of the solutions we've been writing about for all of that time, whether they were good enough, because on things that I care deeply about, we were actually going backwards as a country. Those things are racial justice. Those things are economic justice and the climate situation. The climate looks like it's going in the worst case scenario that a lot of scientists have predicted. Racial justice, we have this incredible wealth disparity that just got worse after the economic collapse in 2007 and all the police killings. And economic justice, inequality just keeps getting worse and worse. So I thought, you know what? Maybe there's some solutions out there that we need to dig deeper to find. And maybe we need to go outside of the big media markets and some of the places where the progressive conferences always take place and where maybe I'm doing too much of my news gathering and get to places I don't normally go to. So I figured the best way to do that was to go on the road and spend the time it took to really see what I could learn.
So you drove 12,000 miles, and for those people who read the book, in a vehicle that you didn't always have total confidence in. But how did you choose where you were going to go?
Well, I started in Seattle, so I decided I wanted to, again, go to places that I don't normally go. So I wanted to start off in the West to understand what was happening with fossil fuel extraction. Thinking, you know, the climate crisis, we usually think that's a global crisis. So if we're going to solve it, it's going to take some big international agreement. But I went to places where there are local communities who are saying, you know what, we're not going to put in another coal train or another huge strip mine in our community. We're going to stop this and we're not going to have fracking here either. We're going to go for a renewable energy. And so this is especially led by indigenous communities, tribes in the West, who have sovereign treaty rights and sovereign power and have been collaborating with ranchers and environmentalists and all sorts of interesting folks to actually put a stop to some of the major infrastructure that's designed for exporting our energy to Asia. Mm-hmm. So that was where I wanted to start, partly because I live out there, but partly because I thought that was a story that was worth pursuing.
Mm-hmm. And then you've covered the Midwest. You came down, and we'll be talking about that.
Okay.
And then you sort of dipped down into the South. Is that right?
That's right.
And then back to Seattle. So it's how long were you on the road?
4 months.
4 months. So covering a lot of places. Kristen Barker, how long have you known Sarah or maybe known of Sarah's work?
Well, I have been a huge fan of Yes Magazine, I think, since it began. I got connected with it and have found it to be really like a cathartic thing for me to read about because it's always focused on solutions. It's focused on people in different places finding really creative and innovative ways to respond to the biggest challenges we face. So I've been an avid reader and knew of her that way. I met her at a conference and was ecstatic when she came to Cincinnati to learn more about what we're up to here.
Did you sell Cincinnati as a possible stop, or was that something that Sarah sort of had come up with on her own?
I'm trying to remember. I kind of always am talking about Cincinnati in positive ways wherever I go.
I definitely came here because of Kristen's work.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely the union co-op movement that I wanted to learn about.
And here. I want to come back to that. But, you know, one of the things, Sarah, that you take very seriously in your book is you sort of embrace the radical quality of the words that open the U.S. Constitution, we the people. But you sort of reinterpret them for these times. What do those words mean for you?
Well, a lot of what it means is that we can't look to big corporations or big government to solve our problems. Partly we can't look to big government because it's so much bought out by big corporations. But in any case, there's a sort of commitment to the status quo among those big players that is resulting in policies that aren't working for ordinary people. So my sense it was then, and I think it has a resonance with our history as a country, is that it's ordinary people when we have power that can make the difference. And how do we get power? We have to do some work together in our communities to actually build that power.
That sort of place-based development, resistance development, it's got to be local. That is the key to all of that, which is sort of the story that I saw emerging from the pages of your book.
That's right. As I traveled, I became more and more convinced of that, of the importance of that.
And of course, there is a long-term view that reform comes from the local level in America and American politics and American life, that frequently the things that ultimately percolate up and are seen as great reforms actually started. They all started in those grassroots areas. And if you're not in touch with that, you don't know what's really going on.
That's right. And you don't know what's coming. And it makes sense because anything that's a really big shift, sometimes it's just too risky to try it at a national level all at once. But a community does it or a state does it. And then other folks say, hey, you know what, that worked out okay. People didn't cause a collapse and calamity. So maybe we could try that.
A sub-theme of Sarah's book that really relates directly to your work, Kristen, here in Cincinnati, is the way unions are redefining their role in American life. Tell us a little bit about how you see that on a large level, but how that plays out in Cincinnati, because people may know about your CSA, your community-supported agriculture movement, or one of your projects. They may not understand the role of the unions behind that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the unions, you know, of course, are not monolithic, and there's all sorts of things that are happening there and all kinds of creative, proactive work that's happening, and that can be really well seen in what we're doing here in our union co-ops. So each of our co-ops, which I think for those of you who may not know what those are, they are entities that are owned by their members, they're controlled by their members, and they benefit their members. So here in Cincinnati, we have worker-owned and community-owned co-ops that are benefiting the workers in the community.
And what would be some examples of those?
So the first one that we launched is called Our Harvest, and the focus there is about creating access to healthy local food in a way that honors land and labor. So as you said, we farm and we distribute that through a variety of different channels.
Just to be transparent, we are members of, mm-hmm. of that.
Okay, yeah. So that's one of them. We have one on residential insulation and mold remediation. We're working on a number of child care co-ops. Apple Street Market is going to be a worker and community-owned co-op that'll be under construction this year. So there's a whole variety. And what these are, what we're bringing into being is actually a system that has had a proven track record in an area of Spain in the Basque region called Mondragon. And this is actually why we're so excited, because of the impact that they've had there. This is not something that is just a one-off kind of a co-op that's impacting a few people here or there. In Mondragon, it absolutely took an area that had over 70% of people living in poverty to, within about 25 years, to nearly full employment. And even today, when Spain has 20% unemployment, this particular area has 4% through this integrated network, this family of co-ops. And that's what we're bringing to life. They made, Mondragon made a historic partnership with the steelworkers in 2009 to launch union co-ops here. And part of the reason they connected with labor is because in the best practices of labor, there's this awesome solidarity consciousness, which is part and parcel of how what is needed to make this really scale and be resilient over time. Because again, these aren't one-off entities. They actually share back profits to the whole. They also share workers between them. So you have to have a deep level of solidarity.
Sarah, how common is this? Okay, you write about it here in Cincinnati. How much is this particular approach spread across the United States, did you find?
Well, there's certainly cooperatives everywhere.
Right.
But actually bringing in the union collaboration, that's one of the reasons I came here, because I thought that was so interesting. Unions have this wonderful history as well as some economic strength and power. And they're also losing ground in so many different parts of the country. So to see the union movement take another look at what they can do to actually protect the rights of their workers and their economic futures through this kind of collaboration, this was unique as far as what I found. There are some other models that are really exciting elsewhere, but this particular model.
So this has a twist to it. It's that relationship to what's happening in the Basque Country in Spain. But it's a very systematic view of the way co-ops ought to work. It wasn't just Kristen's work here in Cincinnati that you focused on. You also focused on the work of Dr. Victor Garcia, who many people will know. He's an incredible surgeon at Children's Hospital. What was it that you were interested in? You weren't interested so much in his surgery. You were interested in his community work. What did you find there?
Well, one thing I found is that for a doctor who is trying to understand how to protect the health of young people, for him to have the astuteness and the integrity to look upstream, not only to say, what do I need to do for this gunshot victim, but what do I need to do to prevent more gunshot wounds? And when you look at that seriously, you see that the effect that entrenched poverty and hopelessness has on a community. Mm-hmm. And then for him to take a look at that and say, okay, what do we do about that? How do we think of health as much more holistic, as including things like our economic well-being, as including things like racial segregation? Those are all things that play into whether we're going to have a healthy group of children or not.
Which has led Dr. Garcia to push forward the ideas of founding companies that he believes can hire a significant number of people. Waterfields is sort of the test case,
which you
write about in your book, and I've visited many times. One of the interesting things when you were in Detroit, you talked about a difference in economic attitude. And it's sort of, there's sort of an economy of enough versus an absolute commitment to constant growth.
That's right.
Talk about that a little bit, because I think that's a very stark way of putting a real difference between this new economy that you're talking about and the existing economy.
Well, if you're a member of a community and you're thinking about the return on your investment, you care about things like the quality of life, things like whether there's a low crime rate, things like whether the kids that your kids go to school with are doing okay, as well as your kids doing okay, that whether there's pollution in the air. You care about a whole series of different things when you're part of a community. And so financial return isn't the only thing. Financial return may be one thing, but it isn't the only thing. There's all these other forms of return. A really great example is city newspapers. It used to be a lot of city newspapers were locally owned. They made a profit. but they didn't make a huge profit. But when hedge funds came along and said, no, we need to make a big profit. We need to make more profit than we could make anywhere else in the world. And then they had to start firing journalists and shutting down news departments, because then they could cram out of that same newspaper more profits. So enough profit was enough to keep a locally owned newspaper afloat, providing this essential service for our democracy, which is somebody who's watching City Hall and somebody who's finding out where the wrongdoing is. But super profits maybe aren't tenable for something that has a social return like democracy. So that notion of enough, I think, is absolutely essential if we're going to have a democracy that does more than extract wealth out of communities.
I would suggest there's really a potential irony, fatal flaw in all of that too, because by demanding that constant growth for something like newspapers, the process is the newspaper business has been really fundamentally undermined.
That's right.
So that lots of communities don't have – I mean, we only have one daily paper here today, which has been plagued by lots of layoffs and smaller staffs who have to work harder and harder to do those jobs. But some communities don't have any newspaper. So
that's right.
There's all sorts of elements to that. You know, you wrote, though, as you finished your tour of the Midwest – and you wrote about things in Detroit and Cincinnati and in Louisville and in places that you visited. And you spoke very positively and what worked here and what worked there. You made the comment, nothing's on the scale that is needed.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the takeaway here? I mean, what Kristen's doing is interesting, important, but does this all add up to something that is making a difference?
I think it does in local areas. It's making a difference in people's lives and in specific communities. And we need a lot more of it because these are solutions that actually work. So at Yes Magazine, part of our strategy was to just spread the word about them, because when people learned about what was happening in one community, they were often adopting that same idea elsewhere. But the more recent project I'm working on now is People's Hub, which is designed to actually train people how to do those kinds of innovations. Because a lot of people don't even know about what's going on elsewhere, much less know how to implement it in their communities. Mm-hmm. And once they find out, a lot of people want to know. They want to meet the folks who are making it happen and ask questions. And via the internet, we can do that so easily and so inexpensively.
So this is sort of where this journey took you.
Exactly.
It took you to another initiative.
That's exactly it.
Kristen, do you get people reaching out to you saying, how are you doing it here? We've heard about it. We've got an idea. We're interested in co-op, but we don't exactly understand your form.
Every week. Every day, maybe. But so that's why we started actually even way back in 2013 having these union co-op symposiums. Because people were coming so often, and we thought, well, let's do this a little more efficiently. And we had people, we have people come who are wanting to create this in their city. So we had one in 2013. After that, the LA Union Co-op Initiative formed. We had one in 2015. After that, there was one that formed in Dayton. We had one in 2017. 200 people from across the country and outside of the country came. Now it's forming in four different cities. So I think it's kind of exciting. We had just a few weeks ago a Pittsburgh City Council member who's really excited about this and thinks this may be a really exciting way to broaden community wealth in Pittsburgh, and particularly, kinds of things are happening.
So mm-hmm. And that's what you're mm-hmm. trying to do in this new People's Hub, is that mm-hmm. what you're calling it?
Mm-hmm.
That sort of interconnection and sharing and growing it that way so that you can get to scale.
Exactly. I came in early enough to attend one of the sessions of Co-op U mm-hmm. that Kristen was putting on, and I just kept thinking, you know, this is great for people who want to start a co-op, but people all over the country might want access to this. So why not put it online mm-hmm. and make it interactive? So wherever you are, you could be learning the techniques that she's teaching.
You know, one of the things I noticed in your book, you go from city to city and you focus on projects that are kind of like Kristen's in the sense that they're operating in the community, they're very local, And I kept asking in my mind, as I read, I kept saying, well, when does this interface with the political structure that leads a city? Because cities are still local entities. And finally got to the chapter on Newark, and there was some of that going on. And is it that Newark was the exception here, that this is bubbled up and now the mayor wants to do some of those things?
Well, the reason that I didn't cover city politics so much is because that tends to be what everybody covers.
Right.
It's always about the politics. And I just felt like the deeper change is happening at a community scale. It's happening because people are choosing a different kind of way of living together. But Newark, I made an exception in part because this was a community activist who came out of years of organizing for social justice and racial justice in Newark and economic justice. And now he'd been elected to be mayor after 20 years of running. He started when he was in his 20s running for office.
And his name
is Amir.
And I'm blocking too, but go ahead. All right. So the mayor of Newark.
You got me. Baraka is his last
Baraka,
name.
Baraka, right.
Yeah. I was thinking of his father, Amir Baraka. So he was elected and decided to really invest in a couple of the neighborhoods that have been neglected for years and are really impoverished. And so I was curious to see how it was going. Is this, you know, how does this work out when areas that have – Newark is so close to New York City, it has huge economic development potential. But is that going to be shared? Are the people who were left out before, are they going to be left out again? And he came into office committed to not allowing that to happen. So I was there only 2 years after he was elected, so there wasn't a lot of big shifts that had happened in that time. But one thing he had done is declared what some of those neighborhoods were and said, we're going to start with this mural project to bring the arts into evidence right here in this city and to say to these neighborhoods that they matter, that their arts matter, that their culture matters. And so that was one of the things that I really enjoyed there, was just seeing what that looked like.
And as I read about that, Kristen, I thought mm-hmm. very much of artworks here in Cincinnati with mm-hmm. that involves young people so much. And
such a cool program.
And communities, neighborhoods do inform the content in mm-hmm. many of the cases, not exclusively. So, Sarah, after 12,000 miles, many stops, many different people, how were you changed by this? Not theories, not your people hub, but how were you changed by this?
Well, the world seemed less hostile to me. Maybe a sort of strange way of seeing it. But after being a stranger in so many different communities and not feeling like a stranger, being treated with kindness and hospitality, going to places that I frankly was not so comfortable in, places which were in the middle of big oil booms, which are full of people who are there temporarily to do fracking, or people in the more remote parts of Appalachia, places which I had not spent a lot of time before. And every place I went found people that I just found to be extraordinary and who treated me with kindness and who are doing things that show that their care for the community, their heart. And so that just made me feel a lot more optimistic and a lot safer and a lot happier about the country that I'm part of.
And has that carried forward over the last several years since you finished the journey and have been writing the book and published the book? And it takes time to do all those things.
Yes, it has.
It carries with you.
It has, although there's been these challenges. I spent some time reporting from Standing Rock and saw just extraordinary violence, people subjected to really horrible kinds of treatment on the part of the government that I'm helping to support as a taxpayer. So seeing that was really daunting, and seeing some of the policies that have come out of Washington, D.C. since the election is really daunting. So I can't say that I have been 100% optimistic, and yet I still have this deep sense of respect and faith in the American people that really was reinforced by that journey.
Well, I want to thank Sarah Van Gelder, the author of The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile journey through a new America, and Kristen Barker, the executive director of Cincinnati Union Co-op Initiative right here in Cincinnati, for being our guest today, and good luck with your work on all fronts.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier, the assistant producer, Selena Reeder, segment producer, Layla Shakui. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.